Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why does Waterloo matter? How has it been manipulated? And how did it become a business in its own right? Regular listeners of the show will know that these questions and much more besides have been covered by the Napoleonic Wars podcast's scholar in residence, Dr. Luke Memory Reynolds, in his critically acclaimed and award-winning book, Who Owned Waterloo? That book is now available in paperback, and to mark its release, Luke sat down at the Lambs Social and Theatrical Club in New York with Professor of History Benjamin Carter Hett. If you haven't already picked up Who Owned Waterloo, get 30% off on the Oxford University Press website using code AAFLYG6. Tonight, in a rare example of me relinquishing the podcasting mic, we go back in time, sort of, to that book launch, and Ben takes the hot seat asking all the questions you doubtlessly scream at me to ask when I interview Luke and yet never do. If nothing else, at least you know there'll be no crime and punishment rabbit holes in this one. This is Waterloo, the battle as big business. Up next on the Napoleonic Wars pod.
I can't say how delighted I am to have the chance to be here this evening at this esteemed club and to have the chance to have this conversation with Luke about this book. I had the great privilege of sort of seeing this book be born when it was a dissertation. I was, as we say in the trade, second reader on Luke's dissertation. So I sort of saw the chapters as they were coming hot off the press, and I knew it was very clear to me from the beginning that Luke was somebody with an unusual degree of talent, an incredible flair for writing, and I will be honest and say that in my trade, I do not read every dissertation with tremendous excitement. But Luke's was an exception, and you know his narrative gifts were such that there were many chapters that, even in the dissertation stage, were literally page turners, and I truly do not say that every day. And of course, he's had tremendous success with it. He won a couple of awards for the book, and now getting the paperback edition. You know, this is a young scholar who's well on his way. So, Luke, let's get right down to business. I thought it might be a good idea. To just start, since the book is about really the kind of cultural memory of the Battle of Waterloo in British 19th century history, I think maybe we should start with the obvious thing, which is just tell us a little bit about what was the Battle of Waterloo? What did it what did it signify? What was the point of it? What happened?
So the first thing that is really worth mentioning is, and I say this as someone who has literally built their career on this battle didn't need to happen. If the British had properly guarded Napoleon, rather than their chief jailer being off in Italy with his mistress at the time, Napoleon would never have made it off Elba for his first exile, and Waterloo would never have happened. But he did make it off Elba. He made it to Caen. He made it up to Paris. He gathered 350,000 very loyal veterans, and he knew that the Allies were not going to let him rest. So he went hell for leather for what was then the Kingdom of the Netherlands, what is now Belgium, to try and split the British and the Prussian armies. The British under the Duke of Wellington, along with their allies, the Dutch and the Hanoverians, and the Prussians under Prince Blücher. And Waterloo is the result of that. It is the final large-scale battle of a quarter century of global conflict. And I think one of the reasons why it becomes so important is because it is the final battle, but also because it's tailor-made for that level of importance. Despite what I said about it not needing to happen, and that is true, it was the three great captains of the age meeting for the first time, all three of them.
Blücher being the third.
Napoleon, Wellington, and Blücher. Ben is a German historian, so I can't dare drop Blücher down. Although truly, it was an Allied victory. It was not a British victory or a German victory. In a relatively confined space for 12 hours, they duked it out, and it was a decisive victory. And that has an enormous appeal culturally. Think about how many film reviews that you've encountered that say, look, it's really good, but it doesn't stick the landing. The third act is the weakest. That doesn't happen here. The third act is monumental. And then there's really, fundamentally, the longest peace Europe has seen until after the Second World War, allowing Waterloo to sink in with nothing coming next.
Mm. All right, so you've said that you've based your career on this battle that didn't need to happen. So then I think the next thing I need to ask you is, what drew you to this battle, or maybe more to the point, what drew you to the kind of cultural memory of the battle? What is it, when you were a graduate student, I assume, or maybe before, made you think, I need to write about this?
So the fascination with the period what goes back way before I was a graduate student. That goes all the way back to reading novels when I was a teenager, or possibly even before. And definitely probably before I should have been reading novels like that. that was when the period, but it was actually my advisor, Tim Alborn, who, bless him, took one look at me, and I thought erroneously that I was a military historian at the time. And he took one look at me and said, no, that's a cultural historian. Yeah. But fair play to him, he let me figure that out for myself. He steered me. He was writing a book about the social and cultural history of gold, which I highly recommend. It's a brilliant read. And he encountered the Waterloo Banquet, which is the centerpiece of the third chapter, and that is this illustration here, because they basically dined off gold. One of my favorite quotes in the entire book actually is a reform paper that describes the Waterloo Banquet as gold-plated military orgies. Tim talked me out of using that as the title for my third chapter.
Pity.
Yeah, right? So he steered me to that. He was like, look at this, because it's, you know, veterans, it's war, it's all of that. And he just sort of wound me up and let me go, pointed me at newspapers and things like that. And I will never forget, I was at a military history conference in Ottawa and communicating back and forth, as you can vouch for, your grad students never leave you alone. I wrote to him and I said, I've realized I'm not a military historian. I'm a cultural historian that happens to write about the military. And I got an email back that was one word in all caps. Finally! and from there, we built on it.
Yeah. Okay, so then the next thing I was wondering about, I've been sort of running this through my mind the last few days. So the title, of course, is Who Owned Waterloo? And that's an interesting concept. You know, ownership of a battle, if you think about that for a moment. I think you have a line in there where you say, you know, on the late afternoon or evening of June 18th, the British Army clearly owned it, and then it got more complicated after that. But here's one thing I want to ask you. Is Waterloo weird in this respect? Is it unique in the sort of contestation of ownership and the fact that ownership was, in a sense, kind of taken from the military? Or is this normal with you know, celebrated military encounters.
It is somewhat unique in the period, in its contestation, and that contestation, by the way, is international. You know, the Prussians quite rightfully claim their place. The Dutch, the Belgians, the Hanoverians, the British, obviously, even the French have a very complicated relationship with a battlefield that, by the way, for almost a century they were not allowed to erect a single monument on. They were banned. But I think in terms of the ownership from a wider cultural standpoint, Waterloo is a preview of what comes with the democratization of war in the 20th century. Because, you know, World War I and especially World War II become these massive cultural moments for entire nations, because no one knows a family that isn't touched by them one way or the other. And I think Waterloo, in a much more cheerful way, to be clear, this is about parties, really fundamentally is a preview of that. Everyone feels some form of ownership for it.
You know, just following this line, I wonder, I mean, I'm sort of running, I know the 20th century better than the 19th, I'm running sort of 20th century warfare through my mind, and it seems to me that, you know, the Battle of Britain seems to me kind of in the public mind still to belong to RAF Fighter Command, and Stalingrad, I think, belongs to the Soviet troops that fought there. And I'm not sure there is the same kind of pull of pulling it away into the broader culture as Waterloo. And so again, I think this may point to something about the singularity of what you're writing about, or is that crazy?
I don't think it is. And I think fundamentally it comes down to what I said about it being purely celebratory. You know, yes, the people who died there, and a large number died in a relatively small confined space, were marked, although I will note that that the list of killed that came out of Waterloo was very British in the fact that it only listed officers. The men were that's a Crimea to World War I development, hence the democratization. But because it's so celebratory, the whole country can adopt it without A, stripping away the sacrifice of the RAF pilots or the Russians at Stalingrad, and also without feeling any sort of problem with what we would term stolen valor at the moment, you know, sort of not claiming that they were on a battlefield when they weren't. And it sort of adopted this whole sort of national context. It was completely drawn to the point where William Makepeace Thackeray, who was a diehard cynic until the day he died, wrote in his travel memoir that he visited the battlefield and its power scared him. He said, let an Englishman of any stripe walk across that ground and he will never forget it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. that does tell us something, I think. All right, speaking of context, I wonder if you might tell us just a little bit about the British society into which this battle lands. Can you just tell us some general things about Britain in 1815 and in the years thereafter? What kind of country is this? What's going on? Like, what kind of society are we talking about? What kind of culture are we talking about?
We're talking about a society that is fundamentally changing in multiple ways. The 19th century is marked by the long 19th century, forgive me, is marked by two massive revolutions, the French Revolution and the Industrial Revolution. And while Britain was very much on the outside of one of those, it was the core of the other. And the Industrial Revolution is fundamentally something that takes the entire 19th century to progress, but it is shifting already that early. Right. So you're seeing a society that is, A, trying to deal with its place in a Europe that has defined itself by war for a quarter century, and that war is gone. So it's got to figure out its new way to do it. It is trying to figure out how to completely change from a war economy to a peace economy, and it's something that actually very that is still only now really being talked about in scholarship. just how bad and dangerous those first 10 years were, right? There is, you know, riots, bread riots. They're still kicking people off land. There's no police force, so those riots are put down by the army and the militia. It is nearly martial law in places. So it is a very sort of unstable in many ways society that is at the same time riding high on this victory, riding high on being really the most important country in Europe, at least in their view, for a while. And trying to define themselves. At a time, by the way, and this is the side that everybody knows, that, you know, this is a country that is admittedly not unique in Europe at all in this way, completely based on class culture.
Right.
You know, you have an elite that occupies probably more of the book than it should, but they're the ones who have the parties, who are out till 4 or 5 in the morning most nights and then sleep till noon. It is exactly the same schedule as most of the lambs of 50 years ago. You know, so it is you have people that are starving and working desperately for a crust of bread, and then you have people who have more money than they can possibly imagine. I know that's hard to imagine in New York and the world in 2024, but
so as a matter of fact, all right, you mentioned the often very deep and bitter social and political conflicts in Britain, especially in the decade or so after, well, decade and a half, I guess, after Waterloo. And that there were no police. And this leads to something which I think is an interesting, in a way, moment in Waterloo memory, and shows how I think in some ways it would have been very contested in that very divided Britain, and that is the Peterloo Massacre. Mm-hmm. Can you just say a word about that?
So a couple of years after Waterloo, there were a series of marches and events, particularly in the north of England, pushing for the reform of the Corn Laws, which kept food prices artificially high, and election laws, because the election system was based off of a country that was no longer in existence fundamentally. Everyone was in the fields. No one was anymore. So you have villages of 10 people that have 2 people in parliament and cities of 70,000 that have none. And there's this massive push for reform. And one of these marches centers around St. Peter's Fields in Manchester. And it was a relatively peaceful march. You know, everyone was wearing their Sunday best. They were, in fairness, actually marching, and they were marching in sort of pseudo-military order. I do want to be as fair to the mass murderers as possible. And the local magistrates freak out, and they call in the army, and they also call in the yeomanry, or sort of private cavalry, made up entirely of the richer shopkeepers. And they are let loose, and due to complete bunglement of the entire thing, they kill a number of people and wound several hundred, many of whom were trampled and things like that. It could have been a lot worse. They actually brought out field artillery and thankfully never used it. But the satire industry in Britain, which had been at its peak around this period, immediately settled on this and coined the term Peterloo to tie Waterloo to St. Peter's Fields to a brilliant extent, to the point where they were producing designs for Peterloo monuments, as in, like, victory statues, and Peterloo medals that were going to be given out to the yeomanry and to sort of skewer the memory.
I believe part of this is that one of the army units that was sent to suppress what they thought was a riot at St. Peter's Field had fought at Waterloo, right? So there's kind of a continuity there.
Yeah, no, there were Waterloo veterans on both sides of that conflict. There were Waterloo veterans marching, and there were Waterloo veterans trying to put it down. Yeah, it's...
So the memory is not a smooth and easy thing necessarily in post-Waterloo Britain. All right, I want to get into some of the specifics of what you talk about. One of my favorites, I have to say, and I remember the impact that reading this had on me when it was in the dissertation stage, your discussion of the Waterloo banquets. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about the Waterloo banquets, your lovely cover.
Yeah, absolutely. So these are the gold-plated military orgies that I was talking about. So from 1822 until 1852, the year he died, the Duke of Wellington hosted an annual banquet on the 18th of June, which was Waterloo's anniversary, except when it fell on a Sunday, in which case it was the 19th of June, to honor the memory. And it was one of the most elite gatherings in Britain. In theory, all you had to do to be invited to this was be an officer, have fought at the battle and survived, and be male. That opens the potential guest book to 1,770 members. The total invite list for 30 years that we have, we don't have the guest list for every year, totals at 120. This was absurdly elite. I have yet to find anyone under the rank of colonel that ever received an invitation, with the exception of aides-de-camps of generals that were there. Mm-hmm. It was the generals in service. Every once in a while, very occasionally, a ranking ambassador from one of the allied countries, and the king. And once Victoria took the throne, even she wasn't invited. Oh. Albert was invited in her stead.
Whoa.
Yeah, so we are talking about a very, very elite gathering. But it is one that fundamentally allowed the military to hold on to some perceptive ownership of Waterloo. It became a public occasion. People, you know, sort of came to see the dinnerware laid out, because this was Wellington was remarkably wealthy after all of this, but his dinnerware service was provided by his grateful allies. So there's a gold porcelain set that was given to him by the King of Prussia. There's a silver set that was given to him by the King of Portugal. It was held in the portrait gallery at Apsley House, the walls of which are lined with the cream of the Spanish royal art collection saved from the French baggage train at Victoria and given to Wellington afterwards. So this is a display of wealth and luxury that most people would never see. And so much like there is a sort of a subset of people that is obsessed with the royals and things like that, it becomes hugely popular. Mm. So people gather outside to witness people arriving. There are years where you can be admitted early to see the table laid out, although you will not see anyone attending. And it becomes a basis for a very interesting form of sort of hero worship, very much in the Carlyle sense of the term. You know, sort of the great men of history, and how they can you can emulate them to rise yourself up. And that sort of thing. But yeah, and it becomes just one of many Waterloo celebrations. The elite ton that aren't invited to that generally end up at Vauxhall Gardens the same night for massive displays of fireworks and military maneuvers and martial music. But Waterloo gets celebrated as an anniversary day all across Britain, to the point where by the 1850s, it's just a day off because we've always had a day off. It takes the same function as, you know, Memorial Day and Labor Day. You know, in theory, they're there to honor the service of our armed forces and the service of our unions. How many people actually honor those with the car dealerships that go on sale and the mattresses and the barbecues?
Yeah. Was there, any distinctive ritual, sort of set of ceremonies associated with the banquet?
So the food is very much the last part. It's insanely rich. We only have one menu, but it's got 34 dishes on it, all prepared immaculately. The menu, by the way, in one of the wonderful ironies, is in French.
It's quite sporting.
Really. It is, yes. Well, Wellington's chef was French, and I think that's what really did it. But honestly, the big thing was the arrivals, to see who got the biggest cheers from the crowd. And then there were toasts. And the toasts were given in strict hierarchical order, because it is the British Army. Mm. You know, always the cavalry above the guards, above the infantry, above everyone else.
Did they toast the absent queen first when she wasn't
they
there?
They did. No, they did absolutely toast the absent queen. And they did drink a toast in silence to the memory of those that fell. But the big thing was that when these toasts were given, individuals were picked out. So Henry Harding, for example, who was the British representative to the Prussian army, is usually tasked with accepting the toast on behalf of the Prussian allies and rendering thanks. But what happens is, as the service of men continues into the empire, it becomes a way of honoring those that have just come back from war, those that have done something special. It becomes a very, very elite form of being mentioned in dispatches. So what you really want is to be singled out with a toast.
Right. Okay, another thing that I found really fascinating in the book is the chapter where you talk about battlefield tourism and how the battlefield of Waterloo becomes this incredible, you know, tourist magnet. And I think it must be stressed, this is at a time that basically the very origins of such a thing as, you know, commercially packaged mass tourism, but Waterloo becomes one of the early kind of main destinations for this, which is also, I think, a fascinating glimpse of a society that is starting to show signs of being a kind of middle-class consumer society. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the tourism?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're dead on. Honestly, Waterloo becomes one of the touch points of the transition from the aristocratic grand tour to middle-class package holidays. Right, and it is, you know, the minute guidebooks start being produced about the north of Europe, it is folded into the Brussels to Namur or Brussels to Antwerp route, and it's, you know, you must see Waterloo, and it becomes a thing of performative tourism. It's not just about going; it's about being seen to be there, being seen to honor the place, and also really to reinforce to the people who, you know, clearly live on the battlefield but have no idea that this is a British site. This is not Dutch or Belgian or Prussian or French. This is British. It's our boys that bled, never mind the other ones. And therefore, this is a piece of Britain in a weird way.
Some corner of a foreign field that shall be forever England.
Exactly. Yes. And in fairness, that quote is apt because there's vast quantities of that field that are graveyards. They're unmarked mass graves, but they are there. The vast majority of the people who died there were stripped of their clothing and rolled into pits.
That's particularly distasteful. Okay.
I can make it worse if you'd like.
Yeah, while we're there, why don't you tell us about Waterloo teeth?
All right. So, yes, the vast majority of those that died on the battlefield stayed on the battlefield. We have a couple of examples. There is one widow who travels to the battlefield, digs up her husband, brings him back to the UK, boils the body down to just the bones, and turns the damaged vertebrae, he was shot in the spine, damaged vertebrae into a snuff box.
Oh.
In which she keeps not just snuff, but the silvered bullet that took his life. The rest of the body is buried. I found this when I was researching, and I still have screen caps on my phone of a message to my lovely partner Claire that out of the blue is just me going, "Promise that you'll never boil my body down and turn my spine into a snuff box." And bless her, without missing a beat, "Of course I won't. Don't worry about it." But in general, the vast majority of people who returned to Britain, if they were dead, returned in one of two ways. Their bones were either ground up and turned into fertilizer to fuel the new industrial fields of Britain, or their bones were dug up and their teeth were extracted. And their teeth were the premier source of dentures for Britain and Europe for decades, because they were largely from young, fit men. The teeth were in good condition, and they cost a pretty penny. To the point where, and it becomes so normal that to the point where even once we get to the U.S. Civil War and the teeth are being taken from those battlefields, they're still being sold as Waterloo teeth. So it becomes, a Xerox machine or a Jeep.
I just think that is so revolting. Okay. I want to change gears a little bit. I think...
Please.
Yes, it's time. It's time for some gear changing. You know, I think anyone who has done historical research finds things in their research that they really didn't expect and really surprised them. So I'm curious, what did you find in this research that really kind of blew your mind? And you said, "I really didn't expect to see this."
I I think the biggest surprise was how national this became. And how, in certain ways, the military just sort of gave up on it. It became, like, they sort of, in certain ways, they fought back, absolutely. And there are chapters that are about that sort of, that pushback. But there are also vast quantities of people that just walked away and never looked back. And as someone who went into this with the assumption that this was going to be, right, you know, a social history of the veterans, that was a massive surprise. Generally, the amount of this book that is about civilians is probably overall the biggest surprise.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you want specifics, I'm trying to think of sort of examples that utterly delighted me. There is a sports day, a rural sports day, that used to have competitions, prizes, that included my two favorite quotes. The singing for snuff by old women, and a single stick, which is a type of cudgel, competition, the prize for which was a good old cheese.
Okay, all right. Now, one thing I think is, you mentioned at the outset that this battle, one of the reasons for its sort of celebrity is that it featured the three great captains of the age. So I wonder, can you say, I mean, most pertinent to your work here, of course, is the Duke of Wellington. Can you just tell us a little bit about the Duke of Wellington? What sort of guy was he?
The Duke of Wellington was, along with Napoleon, this can also be said of him, one of the great masters of self-image of the 19th century. To my mind, only in this respect, to be clear, he ranks with Washington in sort of the ability to preserve his own self-image. He was a diehard aristocrat, even though he was born into a only minor noble family. He was an arch conservative in certain ways. In other ways, he was actually relatively progressive within the Tory system. But he was very class bound. He was very hide bound. He saw the revolution and reform afterwards as, to a certain extent, a slippery slope that could lead only to the guillotine. And so he tried to, in every way, to preserve what he could. He was a diehard opposer to the Great Reform Act. He was a diehard opposer to the abolition of the purchase system. This is one of those wonderfully unique British things. In the 19th century, fundamentally up until the 1870s, officers purchased their rank and purchased promotion. And it was a way to guarantee that the right people were in command. And he was a diehard defender of that. But he was fundamentally very...
He must surely have understood that that brought a lot of really incompetent officers.
He did. He did. But he also credited that system with his own rise.
Ah, okay.
And therefore, it could do no wrong.
Okay.
But also, fundamentally, I think where he got his support for that was tied into the use of the military as a police force. It guaranteed that the people in command of the guns had a vested interest in the land and the old system.
Well, we've never heard that kind of thing before in politics.
Never.
All right. One last thing I want to ask you, and then I think we'll give the folks here a shot at asking you things. But you end off in the middle of the 19th century with the death of the Duke of Wellington, and I want to invite you to speculate a little bit. I mean, you've stressed how the memory of this battle became national, and by that you mean the memory was spread diffusely across the society, and in a sense, the whole society mm-hmm. claimed it.
Yeah.
How much did that continue, and how much is it still so today? Do you think the battle still holds something like that place in the minds of British people, or is it off the radar screen, so to speak, now?
I think it's largely off the radar screen. I think for the average Brit, Waterloo is a train station. It's a bridge. It is one of the several dozen pubs scattered across the country. It is not
a song by ABBA.
Yes, it is definitely the song by ABBA. It is not the sort of national triumph that it was. I think that was replaced by. I think the place that it occupied, the closest, honestly, is probably the Battle of Britain and the Blitz spirit.
Right.
All of that sort of took over. I think its death blow truly was World War I, but it didn't help that the year after the Duke of Wellington's death, right, who was sort of this great avatar of the victory, Britain found itself involved in a European war in which the people dying right next to the British soldiers were French soldiers, the Crimea, and suddenly celebrating a victory seems in slightly poor taste. And there's commentary at the time that sort of says this.
And now that you mention it, is it not the case that a lot of the incompetence in command in the Crimean War in the British Army was attributable to the purchase system?
Not only the purchase system, it was also attributed to the fact that once Wellington defeated Napoleon, along with Blücher, he did his damnedest to keep that army and that system exactly as it was. So we have 40 years of technological advancement. We have firearms that are faster and more accurate to 3 times the range with exactly the same level of logistics and planning and problems that there were 30 years ago. Mm. It's that really nasty imbalance of technology and tactics. And you pair that with an incompetence of thinking, no, we don't need winter clothing for a campaign in Russia, even admittedly the south of Russia, or what is today the Ukraine, to give it its proper name. And you have a disaster.
Right. I can't think of anyone else who would invade Russia without winter clothing, so this gets more squarely into my turf. All right. I'd like to turn it out to questions. The practical problem I have here is I can't see you. So somehow we're going to have to encourage people to ask questions.
I think Don is going to get the lights, which
okay.
might help with that.
Hey, there we go.
There it is.
Okay, that helps.
Sorry.
All right, so let's open it up to questions for Luke.
On this side.
Yeah,
oh, yes. Yes.
Luke, you're obviously an expert on this battle and on the spirit. I was wondering if over the course of your research, was there something you learned about Waterloo, Napoleon, Wellington that really surprised you that was not what you might have thought going in? That's a bit on the spot.
Other than the teeth?
I think it's fascinating. And the more I dig into this, the more interested I get in it. Is the relationship that Britain has had with Napoleon. Napoleon was Britain's bête noire. He was the great enemy. He was the Corsican ogre. He was the tyrant. The idea that Napoleon was artificially short, he was a perfectly average height for his age, for the age, not his age, is thanks to British caricature. Trying to pull him down.
Really?
Yeah, trying to make him sort of this imp-like figure. It didn't help that he had a fondness for hanging around with very large men in very large hats. But he's this sort of bête noire that becomes domesticated, but also to a very large extent, and I don't use this term lightly, fetishized. His horses are put on display. His carriage is put on display. His toiletry kit is put on display, right? Items that he interacted with in as much privacy as any emperor ever has. are sort of pawed over by the mob. The bottom image, actually, on my cover is of a bunch of very, very corpulent, let's go with that, and horny as well, I will freely admit, British citizens climbing all over Napoleon's carriage, trying to get as many in as possible. It was a 19th century version of phone booth stuffing, for those of you who remember that trend from the 1950s and 60s. And sort of this domestication, he becomes this, you know, this figure that in Britain beating him, he becomes a pet in a way. But at the same time, and this is a question I get asked at every conference I go to, if you go to the gift shop on Waterloo, on the Waterloo battlefield, and there are multiple ones, you will not find busts of Wellington. You will not find busts of Blücher. But by God, you will find busts of Napoleon. So it's that sort of... It is, and part of this is Napoleon himself. He was extremely good at this. But he managed to turn that loss into a very strange form of legacy.
All right, good. Yes, in the front.
I have a question that's inspired by the fact that you mentioned that your love of military, as it turns out, cultural history, was inspired by novels, actually. Mm. I'm curious about the role of literature in the dissemination of Waterloo. How represented is it by novelists? Is that the main way in which the imaginary of Waterloo is created, or is it historical or journalistic sources?
It is all of the above. But honestly, when it comes to artistic representation, novels are secondary. Mm-hmm. It is performance. It is reenactment. Mm-hmm. That is the reenactment and performance as entertainment, to be clear. That is the center of this, along with art and things like that. Are there novels? Absolutely. Roughly half of the sort of cultural myths that emerge out of Waterloo that have no basis in truth are thanks to Victor Hugo's Les Mis, Les Misérables. You know, Thackeray himself makes Waterloo a central part of Vanity Fair. And there are others as well. But honestly, and actually this ties into... To what Ben and Daisy asked me, I was genuinely surprised at how little there is outside of the sort of the ones that are named and the ones that are known. There's not that much. And what there is about officers more than it is about the battle. And it tends to be, in that wonderfully British way, ruthlessly, cuttingly parodic. Mm-hmm. It's about fops. And things like that. You know, it's caricature, sometimes in literature, sometimes in fiction. But yeah, no, it is obviously something that becomes the center of a great deal of work. But I was genuinely surprised at how few novels are centered around it.
Well, this is actually odd and surprising, it seems to me, in a country so renowned for novel writing, in a time so renowned for novel writing. Does this tell us something about a differing class take on Waterloo, or a differing, I don't know, intellectual sort of contempt for a military subject, or something like that?
I think it's partly both of those things. I think it is. There is absolutely a class thing going on here. You know, if you think about the novels that we all associate with this period, they tend to be sort of drawing room novels. They are Jane Austen or Disraeli or the others, Rossetti. Yeah, a slightly more mannered writing, whether in whatever form you want to use that term. And I think that is partially it, where officers figure in those, where soldiers figure in those, they come in three categories. They come as deus ex machina. They come as rakes there to strip people of their reputation, or they come as charming cads that can be reformed. The term that is generally used is scarlet fever. Yeah. I think it's also partially the fact that the 1830s saw a massive boom in memoirs from soldiers. And I think it was viewed that that was still their territory. They wrote those in a very eyewitness sense. They deliberately did not mention things they did not see to sort of emphasize that they were there. And I think it was generally considered to be sort of their territory. Although you can very clearly see the trend from sort of Romantic and Gothic literature to those memoirs to Victorian boyzone adventure novels.
Huh. Interesting. G.A. Henty, etc.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Could you give us an Anthony Beaver quickie overview of the battle itself, the tactics and the squares and. I know you're not a military.
No, absolutely.
He's kind of a military man. However much he might want to deny it.
So Waterloo is a valley. It was marked by high ridges on both sides, one of which is no longer there. The other one is. And it was identified by Wellington about a month before as an absolutely perfect place to fight a defensive battle. So he put his troops there. He set them up on the top of the northern ridge. And slightly behind the northern ridge, which had the advantage of shielding them from the French artillery. And he waited for Napoleon. And his goal was to wait there until Napoleon arrived, and then Blücher and the Prussians arrived. That was the understanding. The understanding was that Wellington would hold them, and Blücher would come in behind them. A previous plan exactly like that, except reversed, where Blücher was going to hold them, and Wellington was going to come in, had been attempted 2 days earlier at the Battle of Ligny, but the French had held the British at Quatre Bras, and therefore it could not be done. Napoleon arrives, his troops arrive, and dawn breaks on what had been, by the way, a torrential rainstorm. The whole area was mud. And whether it was to dry the ground, whether it was because Napoleon was arrogant, whether it was because, according to legend, he had piles that day. He waited. He waited until the ground was dry at around 11, and then he attacked. He pushed his soldiers through multiple times, and multiple times they were held back. They tried and failed multiple times to take the farmhouses that are on the battlefield itself. They do eventually take one of them and set the other one on fire. And he keeps pushing, and the Allies just keep holding. They just keep holding. At one point, he unleashes what is still, I believe, the largest cavalry charge of the 19th century. He unleashes the entire massed cavalry of the French army.
That would surely have to be the largest cavalry charge in history then, right?
I believe so.
I don't think there were real big ones in the 20th century.
Yeah, so the one pushback debate is Leipzig, the year 2 years before.
Oh, okay.
That could have been it, but it was one of those two. Leipzig, by the way, was also the largest battle pre-World War I in Europe. And that is where the squares come in. The Allies hold them in square. They're massacred by artillery because squares, which are perfect for defending against cavalry, are a target for artillery. Napoleonic warfare is effectively a really brutal game of rock, paper, scissors. You can defend against one of two, but the other two are not good. And then reports finally come through that the Prussians are advancing. The Prussians are coming in. It's debatable whether Napoleon took this seriously or whether he thought it was his Marshal Grouchy and the 30,000 men that he had given him. But effectively what ends up happening is Napoleon, the French army, and the Dream of the Hundred Days are crushed between the anvil of the Anglo-Dutch and the hammer of the Prussians coming in behind them. And it's too much. And the French army dissolves. It breaks. And that includes the Imperial Guard, who had never, in theory, broken before. There is a popular theory that, the French army saw the Imperial Guard break and went, well, if they can't do this, no one can. And it is true that the Anglo-Dutch stopped the Imperial Guard with gunfire and came in along their flanks and did break them. But anyone who's ever been even at a reenactment of a 19th century battle will know full well that there is no chance the French army could see the Imperial Guard break. There was way too much smoke on that battlefield.
Yeah.
So I think it really fundamentally was the 12 hours of combat and an army coming in on their right flank. And they just sort of went, nope, we're done. Sorry. And the British and the Dutch were exhausted. And so the Prussians chased the French. And eventually they all ended up in Paris. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
So you've written this award-winning book. And I'm curious, are you done with Waterloo? Or have you, in the process of doing your research and writing, have you discovered more questions or mysteries that you want to explore next?
I'm currently working on two different projects. And both are tinged with Waterloo, let's say. They're stained with it. One of the centerpieces of the popular culture chapter of this book is a hippodrama, horse theater, one of the two most successful hippodramas ever staged in Britain. It ran on and off for over 40 years. Which, given the cutthroat nature of West End theater at the time, which is even worse than the cutthroat nature of West End theater today, is an achievement. That script is, and I do not say this lightly, bananas. And so I have located that script, the stage, the regular stage adaptation without horses, and the toy theater version. Yes, I have that. So it was done in forms, it was done basically as paper dolls that you cut out and hand-painted, and you could do your own theatrical productions. And honestly, I think for a lot of young men at the time, it not only fulfilled a theatrical role, but it also fulfilled the role that would eventually be taken over by toy soldiers. Mm. It was sort of their way of playing with their heroes. And it was enormously popular, so I am working on what will become a source book that analyzes all three of those scripts. I have, thanks to the generosity of the Knoll Collection at Louisiana State University Shreveport, access to the full colored plates of that production, which will be illustrated throughout. And that is sort of my foray into theatrical history as well as cultural and military history. So that's the small project. The other thing, and Ben can vouch for this as well, the question I was continually asked when this was presented to my readers and then when it went out to peer review for publication was, this is fascinating. What about the Empire? And the answer to that is, there's too much for the Empire to be a chapter. The Empire is a book in and of itself. And so the next actual monograph is commemoration and national identity and imperial identity throughout the empire. And the first two chapters of that are going to focus on Waterloo, or Trafalgar and Waterloo, to give them the correct chronological order, across the empire. So I'm not done with it yet, but how much more beyond that happens, we will have to see.
How do you feel Trafalgar compares as an iconic battle to Waterloo?
Trafalgar has two massive advantages. Number one, Britain has always been and will always be a nautical country. There is no place in that entire nation that is more than 150 miles from the ocean, from the sea. So the Navy is hugely important. And crucially, also, the Navy is non-threatening. The Navy cannot put down riots. The Navy cannot steal your daughter. Well, actually, they can, but that's a whole different question. They don't do it to the same level. And the Navy, crucially, of course, is treated kindly by Jane Austen because two of her brothers were in the Navy, and they begged her very nicely to please not do to the Navy what you did to the Army. Be nice to us. So there is that aspect, right? There's that. And there's also the fact that Waterloo memory goes back and forth largely thanks to what the Duke of Wellington does. Right, he preserves it in certain ways. He becomes the avatar of truth. He becomes sort of this remarkable figure in almost a peer review of fact. But he also does things like oppose the Great Reform Act and past Catholic emancipation that makes him wildly unpopular in certain areas. Nelson doesn't do any of that because Nelson died in his moment of victory. He gets to ascend to national sainthood without any problems.
Right.
And so you have that, and that is the reason why you have a Trafalgar Square and Nelson's Column, and you don't have a Waterloo Square.
Hmm.
And you had a Wellington statue on top of the Victory Arch in what is now Green Park, but it was so outrageously oversized that it was, the minute he died, it was shipped off, it was taken off that arch and shipped off to Sandhurst, where it now resides. There's a popular legend that is sadly almost definitely apocryphal that that statue on the arch was so ridiculous that a French veteran traveling to London saw it and declared, "My God, we are avenged." That is definitely not true, but that is why there is a, why Nelson is sort of ranked almost above Wellington in certain ways.
Huh.
Nelson is also the one buried directly under the Dome of St. Paul's.
Right.
He is the center of that. Wellington is buried off to the side. Although at the end of his funeral, his coffin was dramatically lowered into the crypt. And because his tomb hadn't been completed yet, his coffin rested for several months on top of Nelson's.
You know, Nelson actually was my entry drug to, gateway drug to history. As a five-year-old boy, taken by my parents to Britain, and we visited his ship, the HMS Victory at Portsmouth. Mm-hmm. I thought it was so cool, this guy dying as he wins his battle. I became like this little five-year-old Nelson groupie. So I get that. All right, we got time for one more question. We got one more question for Luke. Yes. Yes, okay.
I was just going to ask, did Nelson say, "Kiss me, Hardy"? Was that the...
It's debated whether he said, "Kiss me, Hardy," or "Kismet, Hardy," which, you know, is fate. It is also inflated beyond all measure. The 19th century Georgian Navy, I would not be surprised if that entire fleet was bisexual. But they definitely had a weird worship obsession with him. His body very famously was put into a barrel of brandy to be preserved, to be taken home. What is less well known is as the Victory sailed home, they drank the brandy.
That's worse than Waterloo tea.
Yes.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think this pretty much brings us to the witching hour. So I just want to thank Luke again for...
I would just like to thank you all for coming. She's not here, but I would like to thank my editor at Oxford for letting me do this and letting me get away with this. And also, thank you to Ben, not only for this, your advice continues to hammer home to me that you can make history readable. And that is a legacy beyond which I cannot seek to travel.
Well, Luke has the gift for it, and I urge you to run, don't walk, to get this book, because it truly is a fascinating, readable story, brilliantly researched, just a historical craftsmanship of the highest order.
Thank you.
So thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Folks, you know the drill by now. If you're new here, remember to hit that subscribe button so that you can find your way back. And if you're loving the show, remember to leave a review. It makes a vast amount of difference in terms of helping this show to reach a wider audience. Much love to all of my Patreon supporters who hopefully are going to start enjoying some slightly different elements of the perk package. Shout outs to my mentioned in dispatches patrons, Rob Griffith, Brendan Teeling, Beatrice de Graaf, Lynn Dawson, Lucy Tatner, Jim Deary, Josh Keeney, Colin Fieldhouse, Stephen Coulson, Jim Getz, Stephen Gillen, Hugh Brennan, Alistair Campbell-Grieve, Andy Meakin, Mark Anscombe, Rob Coughlin, Bruinsgirl, Noah Fink, Mark Trowbridge, Miles Reedy, Nick Overland, Graham Goodwin, Chris Pramus, Anthony Gumbau, Anonymous American, Martin Pisani, Auric Decardo, James Fluick, Roger O'Donnell, Natasha Hobday, Rod Schwager, Chris Kimball, Gary Dennis, David Graylick, Ted Andrews, David Malinsky, Richard Anderson, Arthur Forgy, Sam Moore, Wyatt Pollock, Carol Dixon Smith, Roland Shark, Jason Moran, and Mark Chestnut. And the Admirals, John Haynes, Ryan Diamond, J.C. Kaiser, Bob Burnham, Mike Guest, Liam Telfer, Todd and Led Campbell, Graham Swidenbank, Rachel Stark, Mark Duckers, David Maxwell, David Priest, Graham Callister, Sean Sullivan, Stephen Ashworth, Dan Hazelwood, Kate Walcombe, Steve Carter, Clemens Bemmon, Charles McKay, Reto the Sci-Fi Fan, and Tim Day. I'll be back very soon, but until then, I'm Zach White. This has been the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Take care of yourselves, my friends. Stay well, stay safe. And as always, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.